We've come to the latter part of Matthew 24. This is one of the places where we have some information that's a little more difficult. In some of the preceding verses where Jesus talked about fleeing to the mountains in Judea, you know, not going back for a cloak and praying that the flight would not be during the winter months or on the Sabbath day, that material is not too difficult. But as we get down to where we start tonight, Matthew 24, verses 27 and 28, the material is still understandable, but it is material that we need to concentrate on and pay some attention to make sure that we, I think, follow the flow of thought. In verse 27, well, let's back up to 24. We'll kind of pick up there as far as some previous material, and then that'll bring us into the main part of the thought for tonight as far as our beginning point. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you beforehand. If, therefore, they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the wilderness, go not forth. Behold, he is in the inner chambers, believe it not. And then new material, 27 and 28. For as the lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen even unto the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. As I said, this is a section of Matthew 24, where as people read it, they often automatically assume that this has to be information related to Jesus' next and final coming. One difficulty with that, or one of the things that people have to answer, is what we've talked about several times. This is prior to the information in verse 34. In verse 34, Jesus said, I say unto you, this generation, that is 2,000 years ago, the people of his day and time, he said, this generation shall not pass away till all these things, that is what's said prior to verse 34, will come to pass. So is there a way, as we look at verses 27 and 28, that we can say that the information in these two verses was something that happened within the first generation? I believe the answer to that question is yes. One of the things that will help us is, and we've seen this from the book of Revelation, when we talk about Christ and we hear someone refer to Christ's coming, usually what goes through the mind instantaneously? The coming of Christ. It's going to be the second coming. It's going to be the end of time. We need to realize, and we have this in English, but there are cases where words have multiple meanings. Or it may be the same word, but it describes multiple things. For example, a father says, I came home. Well, could that describe more than one day? All right, could be yesterday he came home. Could be today. Could be last week. Could be last month. So without some additional information, it's not wise to go ahead and conclude, well, this refers to this particular day. We know that Jesus came in the sense of about 2,000 years ago, Matthew 20, 28, for the Son of Man is come. Let's look at some other passages, though. Let's get some helpers lined up here. We'll probably need about three or four people. Matthew 10, 23, you'll have some opportunity to get there, Steve. Matthew 10, verse 23. Also, let's look at Luke 19. We'll start with Luke 19, 28, and then also read verses 41 through 44. Luke 19, 28, and then verses 41 through 44, Josh. From the book of Revelation, we'll look at two passages in Revelation 2, Revelation 2, 5, and Revelation 2, 16. Steve, 2, 5, and 2, 16. And Betty, if you move over to the next chapter, Revelation chapter 3, verse 3. Let's go back to where we started, Matthew 10, verse 23. Okay, in Matthew 23, do we have a coming of Jesus referred to? Oh, yes. But would you say that that's the second coming? It doesn't sound like it. He says, you know, you're not going to make it through the city of Israel till the Lord comes. Well, you think they had time in their lifetime to make it through the city of Israel? They've been gone for a long time. So there, if we wouldn't say that that coming was a reference to Jesus' next and final coming, what coming would it be? I think the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24. Jesus, this was only 40 years out. And these fellows, they were going to work. They were going to work hard. But Israel, if you think about every village, every community, it was going to be difficult to get through every place. So there is a passage where people are hard-pressed to refer that to Jesus' next and final coming at the end of time, but not too difficult to refer that to what we find as far as the destruction of Jerusalem. Let's look at Luke 19. Josh, I think this is you, isn't it? Luke 19, 28, and then we'll look at verses 41 to 44.
And when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem.
Okay, so we know Jerusalem is under consideration from the context. Luke 19, 28, and now let's look at verses 41 to 44, same chapter.
And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, would that you, even you, had known on this day this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you, and surround you, and hem you in on every side, and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation.
Okay, now it's not the word coming here, but you do have the synonym for it, the day of visitation. Christ was going to come and visit people. Christ was going to come. Well, what's the coming here? What's this day of visitation by the Lord? It's specifically Jerusalem, as you look at the two verses that we gave, Luke 19, verse 28, and then also as he begins in Luke 19, verse 41. Then, let's see, Steve, where do you, right? Revelation 2, 5. Okay, he says, I'll come to who? The world? No, I'll come to you, this congregation. Well, what would that coming be? The Lord says, I'm going to come to you. Come to you how? Come in the sense of judgment, punishment. You're going to experience divine wrath. And that's not the only time he did this. Look at verse 16. Okay, the same point. And then we see this again in Revelation chapter 3, verse 3. Betty, that's you, isn't it?
Yes. Remember therefore how thou hast received and heard, and hold fast and repent. But therefore thou shalt not watch, I will come on thee as a thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I will come upon thee.
All right. Not a reference to his next and final coming, but he talks about coming in the sense of punishing people, punishing God's people, Christians, congregations, if they were not willing to do what's right. Now, let's take a look at this in verse 27, the lightning. For as the lightning comes forth, he says, as, he uses the comparison, so it's an expression of quickness. Like the lightning comes from the east and is seen even to the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Let's go back and rehearse for a little bit. Let's go back and review some of the things that we've talked about. As we go back to verse 16, do you see there a word which would be parallel to the idea of lightning flashing? Anything in Matthew 24, 16? You need to flee. Why? All right, but think specifically. That's true. But think specifically about the word flee. You know, what's the opposite of flee?
Stay.
All right, okay, stay is going to be part of that. Or if you're not staying, if you decide to move, what kind of movement are you going to have as far as the opposite? All right, it's going to be a walk. It's going to be this leisurely pace. You're just going to kind of mosey along. So he's already introduced the idea of fleeing. And then you have in verse 17, what idea? If you're on the housetop, Jesus said, you don't go down. Why? Because verse 16 tells us that you need to flee. Then what point do we find in verse 18? Yeah, that's right. As we look at 18, if you're in the field, you don't have time to come back and get something as simple as your cloak. Then what point do we find in verse 19? All right, you better hope you're not pregnant. And you better hope that when Jerusalem is attacked, you're not trying to nurse a baby. Why? Because you got to flee? Don't have time to go in and pack up any baby clothes or even your own personal cloak. And then in verse 20, the situation you're going to have to flee from is so bad, pray that you're not going to have to run out on the in the winter months. Jesus has given, prior to verse 27, multiple illustrations. Flee, run, no cloak, bad news for the pregnant women, bad news for the people in the winter months. And now he comes along and he's just building on the thought. He says this coming, not his next and final coming, but the coming in the sense of his punishment on the people of Jerusalem. How does he compare it now? It's like lightning. It's going to be swift, it's going to be quick. And it is one more way of saying, don't think that you can dilly-dally. Don't think that you can wait around, because Rome is going to be very, very swift. And it's not going to be a good thing. Now, we talked about in previous classes, and I'll give you some additional information that I didn't give to you last week. But history, if it's right, it says that more than 1 million people were killed as the Romans attacked the Jewish people. And when you think about this, and then you look ahead at the next verse, verse 28, and this should be one tip-off that we're not dealing with the end of time. What kind of creatures are mentioned in verse 28?
Eagles.
Do you have another word there? Maybe in a footnote?
Vultures.
In ancient times, people classified vultures and eagles together. I think even people do today. You know, they see a big bird up there and it may be an eagle, but well, it's a vulture. Well, okay, they're both birds that will feed on dead carcasses. But when you've got a situation where you have people who are dying, and especially in this case, if you've got close to 1 million people who are dying, you think the birds of prey are going to swoop in? It is banquet time. And that's what Jesus is talking about. If verse 27 refers to the next and final coming of Jesus, how do you associate vultures or eagles with that? What's going to happen to them? They're going to be burned up. 2 Peter chapter 3, the works along with the earth, Peter says, are going to be destroyed. So what we have in 28 helps us understand that he's not talking about something at the end of time. Some other people think that the Roman soldiers had eagles or vultures on their staff, and when they came in, they desecrated the temple, as we talked about back in verse 15 with the abomination of desolation, and that could be true as well. But there was certainly no doubt when this experience happened that God was no longer the protector of the Jewish people. From the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 till the end of time, God's people are those who become Christians and follow the New Testament. Now, if you remember last week, and maybe we touched on this a class or two before that, I said that the destruction in Jerusalem isn't back in verse 21 where Jesus said this is going to be the worst thing. Yeah, it's 21. For there shall be great tribulation, such as had not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. So it was going to come, it was going to come fast, and it was bad. Josephus talks about a situation, and this is just one, where there were 2,000 people. They decided that they were going to desert the city of Jerusalem. They decided that they were going to go out and seek refuge and shelter. But it's like anything else. If you're going to go out into the wild, wild world, always good to take some stuff with you, right? Do you remember what we said as far as why the Romans wanted to tear down the walls? The gold. Remember, you got the fire and the gold begins to melt and they go in there and they just start ripping apart the blocks. Well, there were some people, about 2,000 folks, that decided we're going to take that gold and we're going to eat it. That way, when we get out, we can sort through our waste, and when we, are out there, we can go ahead and have some money with us. Well, when you're desperate, I mean, we talked about this last week. Don went back to 2 Kings 6 and gave us the Old Testament reference of one lady eating the child. And now, from what we talked about, there were several examples of that. But these people, they were absolutely desperate. So these 2,000 folks that got some gold, they decided that they were going to, go outside the city and then have some stuff with them. But there were some people who learned about that. And these 2,000 people, they were caught, they were killed, and they were ripped open. Their stomach contents were sifted through for the gold content. Now, can you imagine that experience happening to 2,000 people in a single night? That's just one night. And that's just this group of deserters. So when you go back and you see, you've got statements in here. We went back to the book of Deuteronomy and talked about the promise there. And you've got this information. I mean, it just was absolutely horrific. And I don't know that anybody has, maybe a movie would kind of, some kind of visual picture. But that probably would be too gross to look at. But I mean, it was bad, bad, bad. So that's why Jesus uses the description that he does, and he tells people to flee, because you don't want to be caught up in this. It's going to come so quick that if you hang around, if you don't listen to my instructions about fleeing, if you're not headed out there to the mountains, for the women that were pregnant, if you don't listen, you're going to suffer, and you're going to suffer a lot. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verse 29? Trace? Well, and there, when you look, for example, at Acts 8, isn't it Acts 8, 4? This may have been an example of divine providence. We'll start with verse 1. And Saul was consenting unto his death, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church, which was where? In Jerusalem. So not just any persecution, but it was a great persecution. And they that were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And then you have in verse 4 the statement that I was alluding to. They therefore that were scattered abroad went about preaching the word. Still fairly early in the church's history, and maybe some of them did drift back towards Jerusalem. But in Acts 8, because of the persecution, God pushes several of his people out. And, 40 years or so is a long time. Jerusalem could have certainly been repopulated as far as Christians to a great degree then. But you know, I kind of wonder in the back of my mind if maybe this wasn't God's way of saying, you know, we've got a couple things going on here. The gospel needs to spread, and at the same time, bad times are coming. And if you've got a million folks, I mean, it would, you know, you think about some of the stadiums that we have today. And, you know, I know the stadiums are smaller than the city of Jerusalem, but you put 20, 30, 40,000 people in an area, and then you light it on fire. Or you do something, you know, maybe there's an earthquake. What's the chance of getting out? It's going to be pretty slim. So you're just going to have to wait through the aftermath and see if there's anything that's left. And that's what history says the Romans did. Over 1 million people died, and they took about 97,000 people as slaves. So when you run the number of people that were captured, very, very small. I mean, 100,000 people is, by one standard, fairly large. But when you figure that 1 million people, or 1.1 million is the official estimate, I guess, the number of people that survived, very, very small. And we talked about the people who were crucified, the young men, the tens of thousands of them, so much to the point where there was no lumber to crucify people anymore. So no matter which hand you look at this event on, it was just, you know, beyond awful. But it was also, as we've said before, as we'll maintain again tonight, it was the way for God to say to his people and to the world, the book has been closed on the Jewish faith. There was just no way to look at this nation, which was supposed to be God's people, look at the devastation that came from it, and conclude, it would be like worshiping an idol because there was no divine protection. And Jesus said, as we talked about last week, if the days hadn't been shortened, and they were for the sake of the elect, nobody would have been saved. Where was that?
24?
Yeah, or 22, maybe, in that area. 22 says, and except those days had been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, those days had been shortened. So he was right. Anybody else before we go on? Don?
I have a question.
Okay. I can give you an answer that's really close, but I mean, if you're trying to pin me down to the exact second, I can't quite do that. But
I'm not trying to do that.
Okay, in Romans 2:28 and 29, Paul said, "For he's not a Jew who was one outwardly. It's not circumcision as far as the fleshly act, but he's a Jew who was one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart." Well, that's what we find beginning on the day of Pentecost. You have Jewish people coming in from all over the world. And Peter says, you know, God has raised him up. He's the Lord in Christ. It's Jesus whom he crucified. People start becoming Christians on that day. So I would put the day of Pentecost as at least the opportunity for people. I mean, there were disciples of Christ, but it was on the day of Pentecost that people actually had the opportunity to, you know, be baptized into Christ and then continue in the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, teaching, Acts 2:41-47 and so forth. So that would be as close as I can give you as far as a day. And then God tolerated the Jewish nation and the sacrifices and the other things that the people who rejected Christ for about another 40 years. But Acts 2 would be the...
I guess the question is, why would he tolerate it if they were no longer chosen people? But, you know, they had to accept Christ, had to be Christians.
Yeah.
They were no longer Jewish or Gentile in that respect, as Paul said.
Right.
No longer circumcision of the old covenant existed. Why would... Why would he hold that against the Jewish people by destroying Jerusalem? I mean, I know he did. So.
Is it Romans 2:10? Stan, did you flash a hand? I thought somebody caught my eye over there.
It addressed the previous question, when did God no longer accept the Jews as chosen people? When Christ was crucified, the curtain in the temple was split. Wasn't that the indication that God had left, as far as people were concerned, had left their presence?
That was you have a couple of things, I think, indicated by that. That was a pretty good attention getter. Because of the way, you know, we normally would tear this way, it goes the other way. And then you have, I think that's symbolizing what you have in Ephesians 2, the division between Jew and Gentile was going to be overcome. plus God saying, you know, the curtain's coming down on the Jewish nation. He didn't do it fully on that day. He gave the people time to repent and time to make things happen. But maybe it's Romans 2:4. Yeah, I think it's Romans 2:4. There Paul said, "Or despisest thou the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leadeth thee to repentance." Now that passage doesn't specifically say the Jewish people, but Don, I would say there is a principle there, that God is forbearing and he's merciful, hoping that people will repent. And given that principle about God, and that's true in the Old Testament and in the New, to me, I can see no reason why that would not also apply to the people of Jerusalem, that they were given that four-decade period.
So you're saying basically God held over the punishing of the nation for the sins of individuals.
He stayed that punishment on Jerusalem for 40 years so that people would hopefully come to the realization that Christianity is the way to go. We need to forsake Judaism. And think about it this way. How hard was it for people to shake Judaism?
Pretty hard.
All right. When you begin to look at a lot of the New Testament books, that's what you find, isn't it? Book of Hebrews. It's all about the superiority of Christ compared to the Jewish system. Now, Book of Hebrews is probably written 30 years after the gospel had been given. So, 3 decades later, people are still struggling with this. The Book of Galatians talks about Judaizers, false teachers, the people who were chasing Paul. So, when you have that history, you know, you're going back 1,500, 2,000 years. You've got this system that's definitely from God. It's going to take more than a day or two to, get rid of the connections of it, even if people have miracles. And I think that may be one of the reasons why God was so patient. But at the end, he finally said, okay, you basically had another generation, 40 years. And rather than let that go anymore, God says, now, with the curtain, again, I think that's a good illustration. And with the resurrection, again, another illustration. But God finally says, if you've not gotten the message now and now, this hopefully will help you.
So he wasn't punishing the Christians, he was punishing
Right, exactly right. He was
so
trying
to the old covenant.
Right.
Okay.
And I think that's going to be one of the other things that you see with this as we continue through Matthew 24. If you've got the Jews that are stirring up this persecution, after a while, it would help if you have the wind sucked out of the sails, wouldn't it? And if you do what we're talking about with Jerusalem, that's going to suck some wind, a lot of wind out of the sails. So multiple reasons for this. And as I said, it was an absolutely horrific event that Jesus said nothing else in history will be like it. Harvey?
Well, the end of the old law was Christ was crucified, according to Colossians 2:14.
Right.
He nailed it to the cross. Right. That was the end of it. And in Galatians, the 3rd chapter, I think 24, it says,
right,
it was a schoolmaster to bring this unto you.
Right. Right, it was. It's a little bit like a will. You know, today, I'm assuming that you have a will. All right, let's say that in the next 5 minutes you die. Well, okay, the will has been written, and the will is going to be put into effect at some point. But, I mean, if you die at, 7:45 tonight, the will isn't going to be immediately, instituted. I mean, it's going to take a little while to probate it. It's going to take a little while to sort through it. And that may not be a perfect illustration, but that's kind of what happened with Christ. He brings in that New Testament. But he spends some more time with the apostles. He goes back into heaven. The apostles tarry for a little while. The situation arrives with Jerusalem. You have a lot of sequential events there that need to be carried out before.
But in order for the will to be enforced, it has to take the death.
Yes.
As long as you're alive, you can change.
Right.
Once that's
right.
Off,
it's sealed. And that's what Jesus did. They had that plan for the New Testament. His death sealed it. It just took a little while for it to be to kind of go through probate, if you will. So you have the reading of the will, which was really the day of Pentecost, and then the doors to the kingdom are open. Okay, let's go back to Matthew 24 and see what we now have in verse 29. But, and notice these words, immediately, straight away, right after the tribulation of when? Those days. Well, if we're right in our explanation, we're saying that those days refers to about 2,000 years ago, the destruction of Jerusalem. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Now, this is what Don asked about last week. And I didn't have the passages off the top of my head, but we'll run some of them tonight. There are passages in the Bible. The book of Revelation is one, and really the only one in the New Testament. We do have the same kind of language here and elsewhere a few times in the New Testament. But primarily in the books of a lot of the Old Testament prophetical books, you'll find some of this in Ezekiel, you'll find this throughout the book of Zechariah. You have what is referred to as apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature is a big word to mean that there are some things that God has communicated, some things that we can understand, but he's used not only symbolic language, but he's used some pretty graphic language that's symbolic or not literal. And a lot of times with symbolic language that's apocalyptic, God's going to talk about his judgment. You know, and in this case, we see that judgment. The stars falling, the sun and the moon losing their light, and so forth. And many times this refers to the fate of God's enemies throughout human history. Parallel accounts for this would be Mark 13, verses 24 and 25. We've said that Mark 13 also has the information about the destruction of Jerusalem, and Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. Now, a lot of times people, just as we talked about with verse 27, will come to verse 29 and they'll say, well, here it is. We've got the tribulation, and we've got the sun, bad things happening with it, and the other things. So this must refer to the end of time. Well, as we look through this, there are some clues. And it helps if we pay attention to the clues. As far as verse 27, we talked about the eagles or the vultures. That tells us that we're not dealing with the end of time. And here in verse 29, there's another clue. He says, those days. Well, what days would those be if we're dealing with the end of time? So, kind of difficult to go ahead and use those days. And then when you start with verse 36, you begin to see the switch. He says in verse 36, initially, but. There's the contrast. Switching to a different topic, that is, Jesus' next and final coming. But of, not those days, but of that day, specific time. That is, beginning with 36, we're going to turn to Jesus' next and final coming. All right, here as he talks about the sun, the moon, the stars, and so forth, in the Old Testament, and this is helpful to have a little bit of background here, God often used this information or these pictures, the sun, the moon, the stars, to talk about powers. The stars are going to fall? Well, not literally. But when you think about stars, you think about those heavenly constellations. And here he's talking about the long-established powers, the Jewish state, the people of Jerusalem, and so forth, the Jewish commonwealth. You have similar information in a variety of passages. Let's go back and look at a couple of these. We've got three or four helpers lined up here. Genesis 37, verse 9, is probably about the first time that we find this kind of imagery. Genesis 37:9, Steve. Let's flip somebody over to Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. Luke 21, 25 and 26. All right, Jenny, Tina, let's move you ahead a little bit to Isaiah 13. You feel like a long reading? Verses 1 through 10. Okay, let's start with Genesis 37, verse 9. Let's start with the end of that. The 11 stars bow down to me. Huh. Are there more stars than 11? Yeah. Yeah. A few more than that. So what do you think that points us to? The 11 stars bow down to me.
11 brothers.
All right. People. And here, as you begin to see this really first reference to this kind of thing in the Bible, it gives you a clue as far as we're talking about people. Let's read it one more time, Steve. Okay, now if we didn't have the word sun and moon there, we wouldn't have any difficulty with it. But when you put it together, sun, moon, stars, these are the same symbols that you see over here in Matthew 24, Luke 21, and also in Mark 13. And when you have that additional clue at the end, the 11 stars, people, what would that suggest to you? Would the sun and the moon also be people, or do you think that we're dealing with, 11 people and the literal sun and the literal moon? All right, we're dealing with all people. And powers, powers above us, superior powers. Powers of government and so forth. All right, let's take a look. And Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. And you can see how Jesus does the same thing in this parallel account. He kind of flips back and forth a little bit as far as talking about this imagery and also interspersing there a reference to the nations of the peoples.
Luke. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken.
Okay, There again, it's the same kind of thing. He's talking about things on the earth as far as people, and you've got these heavenly constellations that shake, you know, that put fear in the lives of people. Think about what happened with Egypt. When you have a coup in a nation, what does the average guy think? Well, I mean, you could have the I want to be nice about this. You could have the thuggish person on the street. He's thinking, well, hey, this is our chance. But generally, the person is trying to do right. When there's a coup in the nation, and you've got the people out there in the streets with the machine guns and the sword, what are they thinking? Are we going to be safe? Are they going to break in? I mean, when you have political shakeups, isn't it scary? A leader is assassinated and people are thinking, well, who's going to step up to the helm? Who's going to take care of things? All right, Tina, you ready for your long reading? Okay, Isaiah 13. And I'm going to stop you, I think, a time or two as we go through this chapter. Okay, first verse, he's talking about who? He's talking about Babylon, a pagan nation, okay?
Lift up a banner on the high mountain, raise your voice to them, wave your hand that they may enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, those who rejoice in my exaltation. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty.
Okay, he's talking about destruction. Now let's, as we continue to read, see if this is the destruction of something in the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars, literally, or if it's something else.
Therefore, all hands will be limp, every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate.
Can I think about that? What are we talking about as far as the earth? To make the land desolate, what people have here on earth, okay?
And he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine.
Okay, and then I didn't ask you to read verse 11, but if we were to read that as well, and I will punish the world for their evil, the wicked ones for their iniquity. Now, when he talks about causing the sun, the moon, the stars to be affected, if that were literal, would that affect just the wicked? I mean, that's going to affect everybody, right? Sure. So when he talks about the stars from heaven, as it begins, Isaiah 13, verse 1, if God is talking to who? Babylon. Good news or bad news? It's bad news. Destruction is going to come upon the land. The evil people are going to be wiped out. And then as you follow that thought all the way through, you get down to verse 10, the stars are going to fall. The moon's going to be darkened and so forth. Well, not literally. But it is a way of saying you're this high, you're this mighty, you're this strong nation. You're going to be brought down. And you have different examples of this. You have it over in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 32. You could read verses 2, and then 7 through 8, and so forth. And then this other little piece of information that I want to give you is Luke 21. If you read carefully, verses 25 and 26, and this is a parallel to what we have in Matthew chapter 24, it's, I think, one more way of helping us see the point. He says, and there shall be signs. That's plural. And there shall be signs in sun and moon and stars and upon the earth, distress of nations in perplexity for the roaring of the sea. And, you know, that's what he's talking about, that his destruction was going to come. He says it was going to be immediately after the tribulation of those days, after the destruction of Jerusalem, and it was going to be bad. There in 25, which I didn't quite read far enough, he talks about the roaring, the billowing of the seas. Back in Isaiah 17, verse 2, this is one more example of how the Old Testament sometimes helps us with imagery that we have in the book of Revelation, plus other apocalyptic passages like we have in Matthew 24. In Isaiah 17, 2, he says similar language. The cities of Arbor are forsaken. They shall be flocks which shall lie down and none... It's 17, 12. I'm sorry, I missed the 1, 2. I missed the 1. And the uproar of many peoples that roar like the roaring of the seas, and the rushings of nations that rush like the rushing of the mighty waters. Well, not literally, but when you think about the rush that comes from water, It's one more way of describing the chaos that comes from any nation. So the Old Testament writers used this kind of thing to talk about Egypt, talked about Babylon and so forth, other nations, and Jesus went back to this and used it to describe the fall of Jerusalem. Apocalyptic language is not that popular in the Bible. It's used about 8% of the time. So that's just enough to have passages that trouble people, but it's not enough to say, well, hey, you know, half the Bible is that way, but it's enough for people to, if they're a fanatic or an eccentric, to go just really wild with that. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point? Okay. Well, let's pick off another verse. Let's go over here to Matthew 24 and look at verse 30. He says, still, and you can follow the line of thought, you know, immediately after the tribulation of those days, and then verse 30, it just continues to build. He says, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This is still in that section where a lot of people look at this material and they say, well, this has to refer to Jesus, his next and final coming. Well, my answer to that is still based on what we find in verse 34. Jesus, again, you know, at the risk of, you know, overdoing it, said all these things that is a material prior to verse 34. And verse 30 occurs before verse 34, said that the material prior to 34 would happen within that generation. And when you look at the time period here, within about 40 years of when this was spoken, the sign of the Son of Man would appear. And Jesus said, when this came, all the tribes of the earth would mourn. As you look at this passage, do you see a difference between what we have in the text, looking at specifically the first part of verse 30? There shall appear the sign of the Son of Man, and there shall appear the Son of Man. Those two statements identical?
No.
I mean, the first one says there will be the sign. Second one says there will be the Son of Man, or Christ. Jesus did not say that this is going to be me. He simply promised a sign. He could have said this is going to be the Son of Man, but that's not exactly what the passage says. All right, if he promised a sign, based on what we said tonight, what might that sign have been? Well, signs have a purpose, right? I mean, if you've got the stop sign, it warns you that this is an intersection. You've got people coming and going, so you don't want to just buzz through this. If there is a slippery when wet sign, well, that warns you as you're coming up to the bridge. If it's slick outside, watch the bridge. All right? We have here a sign. What do you think the sign is for? What did we just talk about with Don and a couple others? All right, you know, and the fact that God was going to continue with the Jewish faith, or he was done with it. He's done with it. All right, was there a sign that God says it's over? The party's ended. All right, when Jerusalem was destroyed. And that is what I understand that to describe here. Jesus says, you know, there is going to be this sign. And it was going to affirm that you have rejected the Messiah. He's reigning in heaven and so forth. So now you get the destruction of Jerusalem. You get the abomination of desolation as you refer back to verse 15. When you think back to what we said in verse 29, Jesus says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be dark and the moon shall not give her light. You've got at the end of verse 30, or 29, just before verse 30, what word? Things are going to be shaken. What do you think Jerusalem got a shaking? Yeah, big time. And all the things that we talked about, I mean, they got rocked as hard as anybody could possibly get rocked. So it was really, really bad. Now, premillennialists and some others do not like this interpretation. But one of the problems they have if they reject this interpretation is this word sign. When Jesus returns at the end of time, is it going to be a sign or is it going to be a personal return? Yeah. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 says, the Lord himself. Now that's real clear. It's going to be Jesus himself. It's not going, that's going to return. It's not going to be a sign. And that is one more of the little clues that as we look at this information that helps us understand he's talking about the you know, whole ball of wax as far as the people of Jerusalem. Then if that's not enough, you have, I think, this little point as well. There in verse 30 he says, then shall, this is the middle of the verse, then shall who? All the tribes of the earth. Well, if you were a first century Jew, how would you read that? The tribes of the earth. All right. I mean, he's talking to Jewish people. So when they heard the word tribe, what would they have associated with that? The 12 tribes of Israel. if you have, you know, you're a member of one of the 12 tribes, and you've got, you know, a nice arrangement there in Jerusalem, even though the gospel has been instituted, you've got the sacrifices, and you've got the priests, and you've got Moses and his law, and all the stuff that you use for thousands of years. And I mean, that's your family history. This is your religious faith. And on all of a sudden, the Romans show up. How fast? Like lightning, remember? 27? And they wipe it out. And you've got millions, well, a million plus people that die. About 100,000 people carted off as slaves. How are you going to feel? You're going to mourn. There's this relative crucified. There's this relative drug off into slavery. There was this relative that tried to escape with the gold and got carved up. I mean, it really would have been a very, very traumatic experience. People literally would have been sickened by the destruction, especially as you go back to verses 21 and 22. And if all that is not bad enough, you think about how the Jewish people perpetuated their religion. If you were a member of the Jewish race and you were a male, how would you know whether or not you were going to serve as a priest? All right, you go back, and who's from the tribe of Levi? These are the priests. And if you're not from the tribe of Levi, you're not going to serve as a priest. Where do you think they kept those records? All right, both of those answers are right. It would have been the temple in Jerusalem. If the Romans come in and do what Jesus said, they're not going to leave a stone untouched. Toward the temple, as we look at history, got torched. What about your precious records? So when it comes time, I mean, maybe for a generation or two, you can keep things going, but after a little while, you know, you don't have that history. You know, a few people may remember a few things, but I mean, that history is gone. And for those people, can you imagine? I mean, it would be like coming in and destroying everything that is meaningful to us. They take away our families, they take away our homes, they take away our possessions, they take away our countries, our country. And I mean, they just strip us of everything that we can imagine, everything that we hold of value. And for these people, especially when you kind of look at the Eastern mindset, I mean, it was worse than being beaten to death. It really was awful. All right, I'm going to say a little bit as far as the coming on the clouds, but let's see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before we get to that point. Okay. There at the end of verse 30, he talks about the Son of Man and refers to him coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This is also an expression which is based on Old Testament imagery. And if people would go back to the Old Testament, you've got cross references here typically in the cross margin that will help you. It would help a lot of people who've come out with some wild and really speculative ideas in this chapter. Let's head somebody back to Isaiah chapter 19, verse 1. We could look at Psalm 97, but for the sake of time, we're not going to do that. Isaiah 19, verse 1, who wants to help us there? Isaiah 19, verse 1, okay, Josh. And then we've talked about a similar thing a little bit from Revelation 14, verses 14 through 20. When the Lord comes back, the picture in Revelation 14 is that Jesus is going to, at that time, be sitting on a white cloud. And that's not the picture here in Revelation or Matthew 24. So the picture in Revelation is different, and I think it's different for this reason. Josh, Isaiah 19, verse 1.
The burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt.
Okay, one more time, read it.
The burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt.
Okay, there it is. He shall do what? He's going to
come.
Notice that? God came. But was it the next and final coming of Christ? No. As we said before, here's a coming, but it is not the second coming. It's not the end of time coming. But he's coming against whom? He's coming against Egypt. And he's coming on a cloud. Why use that imagery? I think that's the idea of swiftness. So people today try to understand that literally. But if you go back to the book of Isaiah, and as I said, some other passages that we'll not look at, that's very, very helpful. And then you have this other point, which is kind of parallel. He says there in verse 30, you're going to see the Son of Man. And people say, well, you know, that's got to be the next final coming of Jesus. Let's go back just a couple chapters. Matthew 16. Verse 28. Jesus there says, verily I say unto you, there are some here, of them that stand here, who shall in no wise taste of death. What's that tell us about the time period?
During that
All right. It was going to be within the next 30 or 40 years before these people died, within that generation. Verily I say to you, there are some here that stand by who shall no wise taste of death till they do what? Till they see the Son of Man come. Well, did these people literally see Jesus come in that first century era? No. But see him come in what sense? To see the effects, to see the power, to see the consequences of his coming. And that's what he did on the day of Pentecost. You know, he did come with power. He was the resurrected Christ. So that's a great cross-reference to what we have over here in Matthew chapter 24, verse 30. Seeing Christ. So as we look at these words, you know, the seeing and the coming and so forth, we need to be very, very cautious about saying, well, that's got to refer to the next and second coming of Christ.